Welcome back to the program as we turn our attention to India. You know, for the past several years, the world has been transfixed by India's meteoric rise in the global economic and political stage. From debates over outsourcing at Indian call centers to the constant headlines covering India's incredible economic growth, India really has fully captured our attention and our imagination. But this unstoppable growth has triggered tremendous social, political, and cultural change inside India. And according to my guest, Nandan Nilekani, it's now time to examine India's recent evolution and solve its current challenges. We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Nandan Nilekani. He's the author of a new book entitled Imagining India, The Idea of a Renewed Nation. He is one of the leading entrepreneurs inside India. He is the co-chairman of Infosys Technologies Limited. He was listed as one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time Magazine and was named Forbes Businessman of the Year for Asia in 2007. It is my pleasure to have Nandan Nilekani here with us today to talk about Imagining India. Nandan Nilekani, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
It's great to have you here. One of the key things that you talk about is this idea that India, with its remarkably large population, a billion people, is beginning to look at that not as a liability, but an asset as India goes into its future.
Yes, I think this is a very important change in the Indian mindset because 40, 50 years back, we thought of our population as a huge burden and we could never get out of these challenges. But now, because we are having a demographic dividend and we have a lot of people of the working age and low dependency ratio, and we are finding that if we invest in our people, we can have economic growth and prosperity. So I think population is now being seen as human capital and as an asset and not a liability.
But, of course, one of the things that has gone hand in hand with that is the growing divide between the haves and the have-nots, between the part of India that you talk about that's still in the 17th century and that part that has moved into the 21st century.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I make the point in my book that demographic dividend is only as good as the investments you make in human capital. And unless we have our people healthy, educated, with skills to go to work, with roads to go to the school and lights to study at night, a demographic dividend can well become a demographic disaster. So this demographic dividend is not enough. We have to make investments in our people and also use that investment to reduce the inequality that you talked about.
And how does India begin to do that on the kind of scale necessary to address these problems?
I think that's a very good question. One is the scale. It's a billion people. It's also time, because time is of the essence, and we don't have much time to do this. It's just, you know, just a few years. So India is doing a lot of things. For example, on primary education, now the state is spending unprecedented amounts of money on education, something we have never seen before. But the quality of schools, of course, still leaves a lot to be desired. So I think infrastructure also, the investment is stepping up. So I think the direction is right. It's just that the speed and scale of implementation is going to be the challenge.
What about in terms of shifting the population from the rural areas into the urban areas, and at what pace that is happening, and is it on track to continue it at the current pace given the realities of the current economic situation?
Well, I think it is happening. It will require a few things to happen better. The cities have to be built and designed better. We need more industrial jobs. And while there is a global economic slowdown, I do believe that within India, there's a lot of reforms which we can do, which can bring about internal streamlining and growth and not depend that much on the global economy.
Mm-hmm. When one looks at India today and sees the areas in Bangalore, in your city, and in other areas where there is tremendous creative energy, tremendous progress being made, talk a little bit about what is unique about that progress and indigenous to India.
Well, I think what we're seeing is really the rise of enterprising Indians, not just in the business sense of business entrepreneurs, but even social entrepreneurs and others. And the key thing is that rather than waiting for the state to solve the problem, Indians are taking charge of their lives and trying to improve things, and there's tremendous innovation happening. It's very much a bottom-up process, which is why it is so exciting.
And how much of that is tied to the global marketplace as opposed to that which operates just with inside India?
Well, I mean, there is, of course, a part of the economy which depends on the global market, including the, you know, things like outsourcing and manufacturing in textiles and jewelry and so forth. But fundamentally, India is a very large domestic market. Only 16% of India's GDP is exports, which is among the least in Asia, and two-thirds of the economy is domestic consumer spending. So relatively, it's less of one of those export-led economies that you see elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. What are the things that India needs to do to create added value to that which it's already doing?
Well, I think that's a great point. I think in all our activities, whether it's in software, whether it's in manufacturing, whether it's in telecommunication services, I think value addition is going to be the key, and I think it is happening. I think Indian companies are going up the value chain in their offerings. They're coming out with new innovations. And those innovations reflect the constraints that are there in their markets, but definitely we see a lot of innovation, appropriate innovation now coming to the fore.
How will India distinguish its brand? One of the things you talk about in the book is India as a brand. How will that brand be distinguished from other growing Asian countries?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a brand which has built a huge reputation in its services. That's one aspect. Secondly, it's a democracy, and I think this combination of a billion people practicing very peaceful democracy and transfer of power is unique, and we have a big election coming up in about 2 weeks' time where 700 million people will be eligible to vote, so it's really the biggest of its kind. And then the diversity of the country, which has hundreds of languages, all possible religions, many ethnic groups, all living reasonably, in a peaceful manner. I think that's unique, the democracy, the diversity, combined with rapid economic development. I think that makes it a very unique story.
Talk about that diversity and the way in which it both enhances India's brand and also the way in which it creates potential conflicts down the road.
Well, I think, the world is grappling with these issues of how do we, live with many people of many ethnic origins, many languages, many religions. I mean, the so-called clash of civilizations kind of argument. And India is actually practicing that in itself, in having that. And while there are certainly conflicts, there are conflicts in India due to religion, due to caste, due to region, due to rich, poor, urban, rural, and so forth. When you look at the scale of the country, I think the problems are relatively small compared to the size and scale of the country.
Given what we're seeing in terms of the current economy, the potential uptick years from now in the price of oil and transportation, is India on more of a correct path in the global economy by focusing as it has on information and technology as opposed to manufacturing?
Well, I think manufacturing will also be required because manufacturing will require, is also a way to create jobs for a lot of the young people. But having said that, I think one of the things I talk about is India should anticipate some of the challenges that the world is facing, challenges of environment, challenges of energy, challenges of healthcare, challenges of social security, and anticipate and develop plans so that we don't have some of the challenges we see elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the challenges that you see for the nations that are in your region, China, for example, Vietnam, some of the challenges that you see those countries facing that India can learn from.
Well, I think all these countries are facing similar challenges. China, for example, is an equally large population. Vietnam is not so large, but all these countries are facing the challenge of improving the lives of the people. And we live in a world where everybody's aspirations have been unleashed thanks to technology and access to the mobile phone, to television, to the internet. So we have to, improve their lives and do that in India and other countries in a peaceful way. And at the same time, make sure that we don't create new issues like global warming and environmental degradation. So it is a very complex situation.
To what extent is environmental concern part of the mix in India right now?
I think it's gaining a lot of concern. I think people are realizing that if you're going to, there's no point in improving the incomes of our people and at the same time degrade the environment so badly that lifestyle and health goes down. So I think there's understanding of that. Of course, there's a lot more to be done. But certainly, I think people are becoming much, much more aware of the environmental consequences of growth.
Are there pockets of resistance within India, within Indian society, with respect to moving into this 21st century world, and how do you deal with that?
Well, I think this is, you know, true of any society. There are some people who are open to change, who want to move forward. There are others who are more conservative and want to go back to the good old days. So I think we have some of that, and there are people who feel that this may not be that direction. But I think, by and large, I think as a nation now, we are far more comfortable with the fact that change is happening, and we need to embrace that, and we need to improve the lives of our people in as fair a manner as possible.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the business of outsourcing and this whole notion, the idea that the phrase that you gave to your friend Tom Friedman, the idea of the world being flat, and how that might be changing given the current economic climate.
Well, you know, I think the basic premise of the world is flat, which I discussed with Tom, was that, you know, technology and the arrival of software and broadband and fiber optic cable, it essentially leveled the playing field. So someone who's sitting in Bangalore and he does a Google search, he gets the same result as somebody sitting in Boston or in Los Angeles or San Francisco. So I think so technology has made it easier for countries like India and China to participate in the global economy, especially through services. Having said that, I think the current global economic crisis is certainly raising a lot of challenges about the world. But I do hope that for example, when they meet on April 2nd in London, they will commit to keeping global trade open, because that's the fastest way for a global recovery.
Uh-huh. What percentage of India's global business right now does the United States represent, and is that number changing?
Well, actually, you know, relative to the size of the GDP, I think it's fairly small. As I said, in India's GDP is about $1 trillion, and only something like 16-17% of that is exports. And I would say maybe across the board, I don't know the exact number, but certainly maybe 20-30% of that is to the U.S. So I think India, related to many other Asian economies, is a far more domestically built economy as opposed to an export-led economy.
Uh-huh. I want to come back to education, which you talked about is really one of the most important things that has to happen in India. The idea, as you talk about, of getting education right. Explain what you think that means for India.
Well, you know, when we have this demographic dividend, what it means is that you have a very large, set of young people. But, you know, young people without skills, young people without education, young people without jobs, can also be potentially, dangerous for a country, because they have all these aspirations which are not being met, and then they can be resentful and divisive. And therefore, I think having, on the one hand, providing them the skills and the education to sort of manage in the modern world, and to, you know, create an environment where they have jobs is very, very critical to peace and harmony and economic growth.
Mm-hmm. To what extent does the Indian education system have to change fundamentally to meet that challenge, or is it just a question of scale?
No, it's everything. One is, of course, scale. We need a lot more schools, a lot more colleges. Second is relevance, you know, in terms of what they teach. Third is quality, in making sure they teach them well. So I think it has all the possible things to be done. But the good news, I think there's two pieces of good news in this. One is the people want education, so they're demanding it. And second, the state is willing to spend a lot of money on education. So those two things are in place. It's really the, you know, intermediate execution which has to happen well.
Is there still an issue of some of the best and the brightest growing up in India, educated in India, and then coming over here to the U.S. for university, and in fact staying over here?
Well, I think certainly, I don't see that as something negative, because I think, they become part of the global, global Indian, and I think they contribute in many ways. They contribute through their intellect, their money, their entrepreneurial skills, their brand building for India. So in that sense, I think it's been a win-win.
What are the energy challenges for India going forward?
Well, I think the key issue is, how do we really improve quality of life without adding to the whole global warming issue? Because historically, income growth and greenhouse gas emission growth around the world has been linear. So we have to really break the link between income growth and greenhouse gas emission growth in this new era of global warming. So the challenge for India is to develop a whole new paradigm of energy, which is far more sustainable and renewable.
Mm-hmm. And to the extent that India's prosperity continues to grow, what are some of the challenges of that prosperity?
Well, I think one is issue of health. India has, the world's largest sort of challenges on malnutrition and infant mortality and so on. At the same time, it's getting all the diseases of affluence. It is becoming a big capital for obesity, diabetes, and heart attacks. And therefore, we should make sure that we don't go from the disease of deprivation to the disease of affluence and get our health act together. Similarly, we have a young population, but as they start growing old, we have to look at the whole social security and entitlements design for that. And then, of course, the energy and environment issues that we need to think through.
Tell us about these elections that are coming up soon. You say 700 million people voting. It's not a one-day deal like in the U.S.
The 4th of November. This is going to be spread over a month. It starts on April 16th, and the results are only on May 16th. And it really is a huge election. It's all using electronic voting machines. There are literally over a million voting machines, so many booths. And it needs a lot of security movement of forces to make sure that the elections are conducted peacefully. So it's really a massive spectacle. It's a very exciting thing to watch a nation of a billion peacefully voting a new government into power.
Uh-huh. And talk a little bit about the state of Indian democracy right now.
Well, Indian democracy is very lively. There are lots of political parties, and last few governments have not been run by one party but by a coalition of 15-20 parties. This election also is going to be very difficult to call because there are so many parties in the fray, and there's no clear national issue which it sort of is there. It's a lot of small regional issues. So I think, and plus, of course, the other challenges in politics include, of course, corruption as well as there are a lot of people of a criminal, record in uh-huh. politics. So there are a lot of things that are wrong with Indian politics, but also a lot of things right because of the fact that we have this peaceful transition of power through a democratic process.
In the larger context of these elections, are some of the issues that you address in Imagining India, some of these larger issues we've been talking about this morning, are they being addressed in the context of the political debate?
Well, I think they are, but also a lot of times, elections do get focused on short-term issues rather than long-term. And essentially, my book is about more of the long-term challenges in front of India. But I do find that the issue that I've raised in my book, which is really an agenda that's there out there, is definitely gaining some amount of discussion around the country.
Mm-hmm. Nandan Nilekani. The book is Imagining India, The Idea of a Renewed Nation. It's just out from Penguin Press. Nandan, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff. Have a good day.